What is up, fools? This is the QTR Podcast. Today's December 22nd, 2019. Today's podcast, like all my podcasts, is brought to you by my patrons. Patrons are people that sign up through Patreon and donate a monthly recurring sum to help support the content on the podcast. I'm going to shout out some of those patrons. I'm going to give you the Sunday edition of the rules, and then we're going to get started with the story. First and foremost, let me shout out my friends over at the Sanglucci Steam Room. My homeboy Sanglucci and his partner Charlie Bathgate run the Sanglucci Steam Room, which is a live, real-time room that updates day traders with steam. That means cash coming into the options market on a daily basis. Why is it important to know when cash is coming into the options market? Because it oftentimes can be suspiciously predictive of moves in the equity market. Anytime somebody is throwing around a large amount of money and has a definitive time span with which they expect a move in an equity to happen, it's probably worth paying attention to. Sanglucci and the Sanglucci Steam Room, they're experts at it. They've been doing it for almost a decade now, and I've known these guys for a long time. They're personal friends of mine. Link to their services in my podcast description, and they're also offering the 3LT playbook, which are the three rules that Lucci uses on a daily basis that have gotten him to the financial success he has gotten to today, and the Sanglucci Master Course, which is an educational course, deals with market psychology, tape reading, and just how to be an all-around badass in the market. So check out my friends over at Sanglucci Trading. This podcast also brought to you by my friends at The Trader's Path. My buddy Pete over at The Trader's Path started his own no-bullshit day trading service. For investors that are tired of the everyday day trading services where you know you're being front-run and you know the people that run these services don't give a fuck about you, and they're just after your money, Pete wanted to do something different. So his service offers investor education. It offers daily watch lists. It offers a live stream every day. So if you're a day trader, you're looking for a constant flow of ideas and a good group of people to surround yourself with and kind of toss things around with, The Trader's Path is a great place to go. On top of that, you're going to get education. You're going to get their trades, and they trade in green markets. They trade in red markets. They trade in the options market. They trade in equities. The only thing they don't do is they don't mess with low float bullshit nonsense or frauds. So Pete tries to vet his plays for his subscribers so that they're not getting trash. And, you know, he's just trying to bring an honest spin to the day trading service industry, which it desperately needs. So check out my friend Pete over at The Trader's Path. Link to that is in the podcast description. You can also check out my friends over at rumorhound.ai. If you're looking for another great tool to have in your toolkit, if you're a day trader, Rumorhound might be for you. Rumorhound is an artificial intelligence-based piece of software that looks at merger and acquisition rumors that occur on a daily basis. And there's a lot of them. They pop up on Twitter, in chat rooms, on CNBC, and the mainstream media. And what Rumorhound does is it uses a proprietary set of variables and an artificial intelligence algorithm to try to determine which of these rumors are worth paying attention to, i.e. the ones you may want to take a look at for investing purposes, and ones that you should probably just ignore, which might be more likely to just be a waste of money. So Rumorhound offers a free 14-day trial for listeners of the podcast. Man, I got to tell you, if you're a day trader, you're looking to arm yourself, The Trader's Path, Sanglucci, and Rumorhound, you're not going to have any trouble finding ideas, finding people to talk to, finding people to bounce ideas off of. And the best part, all good people that I know, that I'm friendly with, that I would stand behind. No scumbags, no shitheads. So that is a great vote of confidence and what allows me to have them on the air and advocate for them and not feel like a pile of shit about doing it. This podcast is also brought to you by my friends over at Corvus Gold, my friend Monero, Nathan Michaud over at Investors Underground, and Traders for a Cause, my favorite charity right now, tradersforacause.org, Chris Boas, Ken R., Chris Bede, Nicholas Parks, Matthew Zimmer, Jay Mintzmeyer, my homeboy, the shipping analyst, Russ Valenti, and Crichton Titus. These guys have their Twitter handles on the podcast description if you want to follow them. Guys like Russ Valenti is a great guy to follow. He's a great trader. Jay Mintzmeyer is a great shipping analyst. Also, some of my newest patrons, Lyle Engel, Collins Davis, Peter Theodoridis, sorry brother, Andrew Plotnikov, Ryan Chapman, thank you guys so much for your continued support. And some guys that have been with me for a while, like Steven Pickens and Austin Keating, thank you very much. My friend Matt Kiefer is still with me. My homeboy Glenn Tung, I know you, brother. Good to see you in October. I saw you. Thank you for your continued support. Aubergine, Randy Goon, thank you for continuing to support. My friends over at Flow Algo are still with me, which I appreciate. My friend Guy Loopy, thank you. And talk about Michael Embley. Thank you, brother. Been with me since July of 2018. One of my oldest patrons. Thanks so much, brother. And the rules for today's podcast, it is a Sunday and there is a two-drink minimum. It's noon as I'm recording this, which means you guys will probably get it at 2 p.m. or after today. That means you guys likely have already reached the two-drink minimum for the day. I do require a two-drink minimum for the podcast. If you're there already, I would like to say I'm very proud of you. Thank you guys very much. Finally, this podcast, not life advice, not investing advice. I hold no registrations, no licenses. I'm not a professional. Do your research elsewhere. Fools. And finally, one added disclaimer for today's podcast. If I show up dead or missing or committed quote-unquote suicide or something happens to me or I stop doing podcasts all of a sudden or I disappear from Twitter in the wake of publishing this podcast today, just know that it's not a coincidence and something has probably gone horribly wrong. With that being said, I don't think that'll be an issue. I think the statute of limitations on this story are over, which is why I've kind of waited a couple of years to tell it. I'm going to tell it today. I'm going to get it out of the way. It will hopefully disappear into, as my friend Antoine would say, the annals of history. And we'll get on with life. But I did want to tell this one today because I was reading an article this morning about a former employee at Credit Suisse who was being followed or spied on by a blonde woman, and it reminded me of my own story of the time that I was followed and spied on by a blonde woman. And I've mentioned it in passing on other podcasts, and I have gotten a couple of inquiries from people who said that they wanted to hear the whole story. So today I'm going to tell some of the story and talk about my involvement with outing the spy who also happened to be the spy that was trying to ascertain information from Rose McGowan on the Harvey Weinstein case. A great primer or supplement to this story would be to read Mark Mermont's articles in the Wall Street Journal. The first one is called Mysterious Strangers Dog Controversial Insurers Critics, and the other one is called Weinstein Operative Played Another Role. You can read those articles to kind of get an idea of what the hell happened, and I'm going to fill in some of the between-the-lines stuff with the rest of the story and kind of talk about exactly how this went down. So it's 2017, I think, or late 2016, I can't remember, but I am working at Geo Investing at the time. And I get a Facebook message, and the message looks notoriously like a spam message. It is from an account that looks fake, with a picture of a young woman who was purportedly a French woman, and I can't remember. The fake name that I think they used was Emily Carone, C-A-R-O-N, E-M-I-L-I-E, if I'm remembering off the top of my head. So I get this Facebook message from an Emily Carone, or it was a Twitter DM. I think I actually wound up getting both. I got a Facebook message and a Twitter DM, and I may have even gotten like a Facebook friend request, and I can't remember if I accepted it or not, but I knew as soon as I got it that it looked a little weird and it looked a little fake. I couldn't really put my finger on it. And, you know, it's in my nature to just ignore these things. And I kind of always do. I don't really pay attention to any type of things that look spamish or if it's somebody I don't know or a phone number I don't know. I just don't deal with it. I just don't pick it up. You know, through my experience, nothing good has ever come of those situations. And this was turned out to be a similar experience, but for some reason, on one of the days that this person messaged me, and I remember I had ignored the first couple of messages, but for some reason, I took the message one day and I responded and I said, you know, okay, hello, what's up? You know, they said they had a job opportunity or something that they wanted to talk to me about. And I'm like, yeah, okay, you know, no problem. And I actually said to the person, call me. I said, if you want to talk about this, because I was skeptical at first of what it was. So I said, hey, you want to talk to me about it? Let's not do it through this random weird looking Facebook profile or whatever it was. I said, call me. And the person on Messenger said, oh, I can't call you. I have to have an associate of mine that's working on this call you instead. And the pitch was that, and I'm not sure if it was the first person that gave it to me or the second person that wound up calling me. I don't think the Facebook account and the person who called me ultimately were the same person. And I later kind of think that this pass off between going through social media and representing themselves as one person and passing me off to another person, I always speculated that maybe that was to skirt some kind of law, but I could never figure out what it was or prove it, whatever. So I said, call me. And the woman said, okay, I'm going to have my associate call you, this woman that's doing the recruiting for this job opportunity, which was described to me as a European multimillionaire whose daughter wanted to go into the media industry. And so this guy, who had to remain nameless, of course, and was a millionaire, was going to fund a new website, a new media company for his daughter to start up. And they were looking for contributors. They were looking for people to hire. They were looking for people to get involved. And because they had seen my social media presence and read my reports or whatever, you know, I was somebody that they wanted to reach out to. Okay, whatever. So they passed me off onto the second person, and I get this email from a woman purporting to be Diana Illich, I-L-I-C. And the email is coming from a domain name, which I think was, I can't remember what it was off the top of my head, but her purported company name was Diana Illich Consultancy. And the domain name that they used for the email was something like DI Consultancy or Diana Illich Consultancy or something. And so she sends me this email and she introduced herself. Hi, I'm Diana. I'm in charge of recruiting people for this website and stocking this media company for this multimillionaire. And we're impressed with you and blah, 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 blah. So I'm like, all right, like, there's something going on here and I can't really figure out what it is. So I, who is the website? And I look up the domain name. And of course, the domain name for her consultancy had only been registered a couple of months prior. I think, I can't remember what the dates were exactly, but I noticed, first off, there was no website for her domain name. So to get an email from it and for her to purportedly be part of this business, this consultancy, without having a website, I thought was strange. But she had a little logo made in her email signature, and I was like, okay. So I look up the domain name, and of course, the domain name had only been registered like 3 months prior. You couldn't get any information on the domain name. They had used one of those privacy shields, which is fine, and because that's pretty commonplace. So that in and of itself isn't super suspicious. But the fact that it had only been registered months prior definitely caught my attention. And we start to go back and forth, me and this woman, through email. And as I'm sending her emails, she's talking about, oh, I'm traveling to Philadelphia soon, so maybe we could get together. Maybe we could get together in person and talk about this and talk about this job opportunity, whatever. And my spider senses are going off, but I'm actually more interested in what the hell is going on. I can't really figure out what this person is getting at. At this point, I put the probability of this being an actual job offer at, you know, 25% or 30%. But there was also this interesting kind of like, well, what the hell is going on here? And this was before I had even heard of business intelligence firms or, you know, this is before Fusion GPS was in the news. This was before all these articles on Black Cube and all this other shit had come out. So I didn't really know too much about that. I mean, I knew about private investigators. I knew what they did. I certainly knew, you know, coming from the world of short selling, that companies and rich people would hire people to dig up dirt on people, go through their trash and all the other shit that they do. You know, I knew about that stuff, but I didn't know, I had never heard of Black Cube and I had never heard of, you know, Fusion GPS or any of these companies. So we exchange emails back and forth and we're thinking about a time to meet. She's coming to Philly. Of course, I have not seen what she looks like or anything yet. There's nothing on her available. There's no social media. I do my normal, skeptical paranoia thing and spend hours trying to research her, her company, and all these other things. And there's nothing about her online at all, which is another red flag to me. So I'm like, interesting. So I tell her, you know, if you're coming to Philly, and I actually live outside of Philadelphia now and have for a couple of years. So I said, if you're coming to Philly and you want to meet with me, come out to where I live, which is now about 25 minutes outside of the city. And because I'm not coming into Philly to meet with you for a couple reasons. One is I don't like the hustle and bustle of the city when I'm taking a meeting that is of questionable nature for me. It allows people to get in and get out and be around without being noticed. And also, too, I thought that if I said to the person, come outside of the city and meet with me where I live, and they did it, that it would be an indication to me that they really wanted to meet with me and would do whatever they needed to do it. And I thought of this for two reasons. The first is in the rare chance that it was a job interview, I would kind of wanted to know, like, all right, how interested are they in actually bringing me in? But more than that was I wanted to be on my home turf and I wanted to get an indication of just generally what this person would be willing to do to meet with me, right? So all this stuff is kind of going on in the back of my head as we're trying to arrange this meeting. And also, I have to say, just to go back, when I told the person to call me prior to taking these emails with this Diana Illich, somebody did call me. They said, we're going to call from a London number. Our office is in London, whatever. So, yeah, fine, whatever. So I got a call that day from somebody with the London country code or English country code from London. And immediately, actually, it was the Emily Carone that had told me she was going to call me. Because I remember when I took the call, the accent on the call did not match what this person's Facebook profile had purported to be. So, of course, when this person contacted me through Facebook, I did this due diligence on them. Emily Carone. Carone is a French-sounding name. Claimed to be a French woman who was in London to work in her early 20s. And, you know, look, at age 37, 36, 35, whatever I was at the time, somebody starts sending a message and their photo looks like they're a supermodel, you immediately start to think something is amiss here, right? You just doesn't sit right in the corner of your mind also. And that, between all these other things I'm finding out, they're all kind of piling up in my head. And I'm thinking, all right, you know, we have a situation here that is likely out of the ordinary. So I remember when the person phoned me, I was thinking to myself, there should be a French accent here. And there wasn't. There was an accent that I couldn't really put my finger on. It sounded Eastern European, but I couldn't. And I'm okay with accents. I can pretty much geographically put you somewhere close to where you live. And in certain areas and regions, I can put you, you know, like I can tell West England from London and things like that. And so I hear this accent and it immediately is clearly not French. It was way too rough to be French. And it definitely sounded Eastern European. After the fact, I started to think maybe Israeli, but I couldn't really tell. But I'm like, the Emily Carone in this profile, whoever this person is purported to be, is not the person that just called me. So that is an aside. So I go back to the emails and decide that this person is, this Diana Illich is going to come meet me out near where I live. Another thing that I noticed that's worth noting is I have a pretty distinct way of talking to people in emails and online communications. So even if, like, if you're a patron and I send you an email, or if I write you an email, you know, I was an English major. I spent a lot of time reading, writing. Language is something that is definitely one of my strengths. And I know how I communicate to people, and I know how I write, and I know the things that I say. And some of the things that I say in written communication are outside the scope of normal back and forth, in my opinion. Things that just set apart my language and my written discourse from the norm, and just certain words, phrases, the way that I write my salutations, just the language that I use. And what I noticed was throughout the course of emails with this purported Diana Illich, that what she was writing back to me was including the same salutation that I was using, some of the words that I was using. And a good, for instance, that I remember off the top of my head was when we had determined a place to meet, I said that would be lovely, which is not something that most people say. It's not really thrown around, you know, especially in the business world. Nobody said, that'd be lovely. You know, it's almost like chiefly British slang. I'm not really sure where I picked it up, probably from watching soccer. But at one point, you know, I recommended an idea and she agreed and I said, sounds lovely or something, you know. And that was just the normal course of my regular dialogue. It's not like I was saying it on purpose. It's just something that I say, you know. People say, how was the meal? It was lovely. I don't know. It's a strange thing that not a lot of guys say. I realize that, but I don't know. Somehow it got ingrained into my vocabulary and I've been saying it for a long time. Regardless, I noticed that one of the emails she sent back to me at one point said, oh, that would be lovely, you know? And I was like, fucking weird that she would say that. You know, that's something that I say. And you just, not, you know, 1% of people in the business world probably use terminology like that. And then I also remember signing off with whatever salutation that I used, and I can't remember what it was off the top of my head, but something relatively peculiar. And she had used the same salutation at the same time. And I was like, all right. And I just kind of noticed after the fact, I went back to and looked at some of the emails. And you could just see the tone of her emails was starting to shift slightly toward what the tone of my emails were like. This personality mirroring. Remember in The Office when Andy Bernard comes in for the first time and he starts trying to act like Michael Scott? It was kind of like that, just a little bit more subtle. And I understand that, you know, when you do that, you're kind of, what do they call it, code switching or whatever, doing it to create some type of bond with your audience one way or the other through your dialogue. But that was another thing that kind of perked up my ears. So I was like, okay. So I prepare to go to this meeting and we decide that we're going to meet at a local hotel where, you know, I knew the staff. I knew the general manager. I was, you know, and I was familiar with the premises. I was familiar with the entrances and the exits, which was one of the reasons that I picked it. And I also have a concealed carry license in. So I decided that just in case, I was going to bring my friend with me. And I even said to one of my very good friends, I forwarded him all of the email communication between Diana Illich and I. And I said, hey, you know, I'm going to meet this person. Pretty sure there's something fucky going on here. Haven't really been able to put my finger on it yet. So I want you to have all this email communication. Here's the name that was used, you know, and here's everything. And I said to him, just keep this just in case. I don't think anything's going to happen. But just so you know, here's everything in advance of this meeting. So I remember going to the meeting, and I remember, immediately as I show up, all I'm thinking to myself is, this is going to be a 6 foot blonde that's going to, you know, wind up being in this meeting with me. I got a feeling. I don't know, you know, there's, I just got a feeling this is going to be some beautiful, fucking incredible looking woman. And sure as shit, a city cab pulls up. And again, we're a half hour outside of the city. And this is a day and age when Uber is a thing that's happening. And a city cab pulls up. And out pops this exceptionally beautiful blonde woman. And I'm like, fucking told you, you know, to myself. I'm like, here it is. I know. Here it comes. And so this woman and I, we go inside and we meet and we go to sit down to eat dinner. And prior to her coming and sitting down at the table, she wanted to make a stop in the bathroom. I remember. So I got to use the bathroom real quick before we get started. And she had showed up with this little black leather portfolio, and she took that with her into the bathroom. And I'm like, okay. Noted. Don't know what's going on, but noted. And so then she returned to the table, and we started to talk. And one of the first things that she told me was that she was in the middle of a trip, that she had gone to New York and I think was en route to Toronto after leaving where I was. And that, which by the way, to this day, I think those were her actual destinations. I don't think she was lying about that. But regardless, she pulled out this portfolio, I remember, to take notes as we were talking. I'm pretty sure there was a recording device in the portfolio. And I can't prove it, and I'm not sure, but I'm, you know, it was on the table the whole time. And she pulls out this portfolio, and inside of it, there is this bright white legal pad. I can't remember if it was white or yellow, but it looked like it hadn't been touched. And peeking out of the other side of the portfolio were like three business cards. And the business cards, you know how like the leather portfolios that you have that open up, they have a legal pad on one side, and on the other side, they have a spot for like credit cards, business cards, etc. And her business cards had peeked out of the other side of the portfolio, and the logo on the business cards matched the logo in her email signature perfectly. Except there was a problem. And the problem was that the business cards looked like they had been put there 5 minutes before she walked in. So I'm thinking, here's a person that supposedly has been traveling for a week or two and supposedly has all this other traveling to do. And these business cards are also bright white, just like the pad. They look like they haven't been touched. They look like they haven't been bent. They look like they haven't, there was no dirt on them. There were no smudges on them. And anybody that's traveled for business knows that, you know, these things, they take wear and tear after a while. And so even if you put a business card in a portfolio, it's going to start to look like shit after a while, especially if it's just a piece of cardboard. I also found it interesting that the cards matched identically what her email signature looked like. I mean, oftentimes when, you know, a company does business cards or somebody personal does business cards, the logo can sometimes differ. The logo can be changed. Sometimes they use a new logo on their old email signature. Sometimes they use an old logo on a new business card and vice versa. It's, you know, 90% of the time, I'm sure they match, but less than that, do they match identically? And oftentimes, you know, if you're taking notes here, something a little bit different in the logos. I think most people look at it and they say, oh, you know, logo, match, good, good. And I'm like, I don't know. Because I've taken a lot of meetings with people where, you know, they're using business cards from 2008 and maybe the logo that they're using for the business now is 2019 because the business cards, you don't go through them as quickly or something. So I just noticed that. And they were peeking out of this portfolio in a way that almost said to me, hey, look at these. This is me. Here's my business cards. Everything's legit, you know. It was almost too much. So we start to have a conversation and we're talking about life in general. And as I'm asking her questions about this purported job that she's offering, I can't get any details. I remember one of the first things that I said to her was, you know, half jokingly, but also half to kind of gauge her reaction was, as soon as we sat down, I said, I'm pretty sure you're here to kill me. You know, I'm pretty sure you're an assassin here to kill me. And she was like, why is that? And I was like, because you have no social media presence at all. And I can't find anything on you. And I can't find anything on, you know, anybody that you claim to have worked with or whatever. And she did a good job of not really missing a beat there. There wasn't any visual tics. There wasn't any stuttering. You know, she played it off. She laughed. She was quite charming also, too. She looked me in the eye. As I later told Mark Mermont at the Wall Street Journal, she often laughed at many things that I said that weren't funny. So, you know, at age 36 or 35 or whatever I was at the time, you know, look, I realize I'm not the funniest guy in the world. I realize I'm not the best looking guy in the world. And so when you get messages from a, you know, supermodel looking woman on Facebook immediately, I'm skeptical. You know, I think they bank on most guys allowing their penis to do the thinking for them. And, you know, 22, sexy, good, you know. And I'm like, something's fucking wrong here. And so as this woman is kind of laughing at the things that I say, I start thinking to myself, you know, I'm really not that funny. I know a lot about myself. And oftentimes when I make jokes, I wind up having to fucking explain them, which leads to an awkward moment between me and whoever I'm talking to, where they usually decide they don't want to talk to me anymore, and I spend the rest of the quote-unquote conversation looking at the floor or the ceiling and pretending like everything's normal when clearly this person isn't understanding what I'm saying. So I've had enough social interaction to understand that, you know, yeah, the first time around, some people usually don't get me, but that was the opposite vibe of what I was getting from this conversation. And it was almost, it was too much. I found out, obviously, spoiler alert, that this woman was not who she said she was. And also that she had been a trained actress. And I just kind of, when I was describing the incident to people, I kept saying she was 105% of who she claimed to be, meaning she was just that tiny bit over the top that it was a tell. It was like she was almost a caricature of herself. Not by much. Very, very nuanced to, I think, the point where, you know, most people she probably didn't have any trouble fooling. And to be fair, I wasn't really sure what was going on. I just knew that something was going on. So we start to talk about life in general, and we order wine, and we order food, and we're drinking wine, and everybody's happy, and we keep talking, and this and that, and, you know, we're laughing, and she's laughing too much, and I'm trying to figure out what's going on. I'm asking questions like, you know, where are you from? She says, I'm from Zagreb, Croatia. And I'm like, all right, you know, which of course turned out to not be the truth, but it explained the accent to me. She had an accent that I couldn't put my finger on in person. The first thing I couldn't figure out was whether or not she was the person I had, in fact, talked with over the phone. I thought maybe she was. And the second thing was I couldn't pick out where the accent was from. Later found out this woman was born in Bosnia and Herzegovina, I think, and then moved to Israel. And the accent, I think, is a mashup between Israeli and, I don't know, Bosnian. I'm not really sure what it was, but I couldn't put my finger on it. So I'm asking these questions, and I'm getting answers that are adequate, at least for her to kind of keep face. So none of the probing that I'm doing in person is really leading me anywhere. Finally, we start to have a discussion on politics, and I led the discussion by, I can't remember if I answered first or if she did, but at one point she gave an answer politically that was vague, and it wasn't I'm a libertarian, but she said something like, you know, live and let live or something. And I was like, interesting, you know, here's somebody that's laughing at all my jokes that all of a sudden, you know, writes her emails in a similar way that I do, and now kind of shares some of the same political ideology. So I'm like, all right, interesting. A lot of coincidences lining up, you know? Either I just met my soulmate, which I didn't, of course, or something fucky is going on. So I can't really understand what this woman is getting at. And I start to talk about Herbalife because that was one of the big projects that I had worked on over the last couple of years. And I wanted to kind of gauge her reactions when we started to talk about Herbalife. I thought maybe that was the issue. Maybe she was working for the company, or maybe she was a distributor somewhere and she wanted to. I couldn't really figure it out. I just kind of press on these buttons that that I'm hoping will lead to some kind of clarity. And she had mentioned in the earlier meeting that she had read some of the reports that I had written, and she had asked about some of those companies. Tell me about this one, tell me about the other one. And, you know, I kind of gave her a primer on those things, but nothing really stood out to me. And she, at one point, asked about AmTrust, which was this insurance company that, to be honest with you, I really didn't have much to do with. I had tweeted about it a couple of times on social media, and I worked for Geo Investing, and Geo had written an article on AmTrust, but that was before I started working for them. So I wasn't really involved with the project. I had read the piece that Geo Investing had put out, and I had read similar critical pieces by, you know, this Alistair Capital. And, you know, there were a couple people that were critical of it that had written about it. And I knew that they had been in trouble recently with Italian regulators, which was something that I had tweeted about. And I had, you know, a momentary interest in it that I think at this point had even faded away, to be honest with you. And so she asked me, you know, what do you know about AmTrust? And I'm, you know, still thinking, okay, this is normal, semi-normal conversation, because we're talking about the work that I've done, really not even occurring to me that, like, hey, I didn't really even work on this that much. And I told her, I said, I'm not really sure. I said, you know, there's something involving being under reserved, and I'm not an expert in insurance accounting, but they seem to have pissed off these Italian regulators, and there's a whole bunch of people that are alleging a whole bunch of things about the company that they had been involved in, you know, all types of money laundering and shit, but, like, I, you know, and that maybe the feds were involved, but that was all just rumors and speculation and stuff that I had kind of heard in passing. So I just kind of gave her the lowdown and was like, you know, but that's really all I know. I don't really know anything other than what I've read and the things that I've tweeted out, whatever. And then she asked a follow-up question on AmTrust. And she said, oh, can you tell me more about how you think the company is purportedly laundering money? Or something like that. That was a very pointed question. And I was like, this doesn't make a lot of sense. I'm like, this woman's supposed to be here to hire me for a website that she wants me to contribute to. And now, you know, when during the course of a normal job interview would somebody say, tell me about the purported money laundering that you think is going on, or whatever the question was that she asked. So I was like, okay, I'm like, I think this meeting is about AmTrust now. I think that's what's going on. And I said to her, you know, truthfully, I don't really know. I said, I really don't know. I just know, you know, what I've heard in passing and what I've been told. And the truth of the matter at the time was I didn't really have an understanding of how this stuff was, you know, allegedly going on, if it was even going on. I didn't even know. So I, you know, I answered her question and I, you know, said, look, I don't really know. You know, I said, I've read some things. Here's some things that I've read that you can read, and life goes on. So the conversation starts to wind down. And as it does, I'm thinking to myself, okay, I think this is about AmTrust now. So the bill is coming for the table and I am fully expecting this woman to pay the bill in cash, which later actually my friend that I spoke to, that I had given the emails to, also pointed that out and said, you know, did she pay the bill in cash? I said, yeah, she paid the bill in cash. Oh, that's your sign right there, you know. Because anybody that's traveling for business, of course, they are paying with a credit card, especially if this woman is being funded by some multimillionaire. So we exchange pleasantries, and I offer to get her an Uber back to where she's going, I remembered. And I'm thinking, all right, like if I can get her in an Uber, I can at least see where she's going. I think she had told me she was staying in Philadelphia that night. And I was like, you know, I can at least get the address of maybe where she's staying. Which, of course, she declined, which was very smart. And then I noticed a very strange thing, which was the city cab she had arrived in. And this was, you know, 2 or 3 hours later after dinner. The city cab she had arrived in, and again, I'm, you know, 25 minutes outside the city, 30 minutes outside the city. There's no city cabs out here. Was still sitting outside in the fucking parking lot when she was leaving. And I was like, ah, well, that's fucking interesting. You know, how much do you got to pay the cab to keep the fucking meter on and wait outside while you have a 3 hour dinner instead of taking an Uber, right? Or what'd you do? You slip the guy $100, said, I'll be out in 3 hours. That guy gets to take a nap. And then, you know, when you're ready, you text him and that's it. So she left in a city cab 30 minutes outside of the city where there's no city cabs. And I was like, that's it. Like, so, you know, as if I needed more confirmation. That is fucking strange, right? So I leave the dinner and I immediately start writing down every single thing I can remember. From what we ordered to what we talked about to whatever. And I still have the PDF around here somewhere, but I got to find it. I wrote about what cab she arrived in, what brand. I think I got the license plate of the cab. I got, you know, her name, what she was wearing, what she was ordered, what kind of wine we had, every little thing that we talked about. And I just started writing everything down. I just closed my eyes and, you know, try to remember every single thing till I had a couple of pages. Then I leave. And I'm thinking to myself, all right, well, I know some other people that have been critical of AmTrust in the past, so let me call them and see if they've had any interesting meetings also. And that was what I did. There was a bar that I was going to that was next to where we met for dinner, and it's a short walk. It's like a quarter mile walk, so in the midst of walking there, I was like, I'm just going to call some of these people and just see what's what. So I start calling people that I know that have been critical of the company. You know, Roddy Boyd had written some critical articles about the company. And of course, you know, he says, oh, yeah, there was this person that said that they wanted to bring me to London to, you know, help them do something, some fucking project where they were going to pay him money. I can't remember what it was. And another critic that I called, I said, hey, you know, have you ever had any interesting interactions? And he goes, oh, yeah, you know, some Asian billionaire from London said he wanted to invest $50 million in my fund or something. And I'm like, ah, man, we got a lot of fucky stuff going on here. I'm like, the fucking stars are starting to align. So I go and I sit at the bar and I'm having a drink. And then I remember that my boss at Geo Investing had also taken this meeting a couple of months ago where somebody wanted to fly him to London to speak at a conference. And I remember him coming back from the meeting. He went to Philly to take the meeting and he came back to the office the day of the meeting. And I asked him how it went. And he said, yeah, to be honest, he said it was a little strange. I couldn't really put my finger on it. You know, the guy that I had met with, I didn't really, I don't know, it was strange, but apparently they're going to fly me out to speak in London, so whatever, I'm just going to go. And I remember him saying that. So that, I think, was a Sunday. I don't know, I don't remember, but the next day was a work day, so I went back into the office, and I said to my boss, I said, Dan, forward me the emails of the guy that contacted you from whatever this, you know, company was. And the company was called Continental Management, I think. And they had a website set up for Continental Management. And I went on the website and there was nothing. It was a bunch of fluff. It was a website template with a bunch of text, exactly what you would set up to look like a company that's a shell company with no real information, no real contact information, and no real references, no names, you know, no about section where people say, oh, here's the president and CEO, here's the chief operating officer. It was just this very kind of like nebulous thing. And at the bottom of the website, I noticed there was an address. and the address was in London. And I pulled up one of my emails from Diana Illich, and I said, these are the same fucking addresses. Isn't that fucking interesting? So I looked at the address, and I had looked at the address prior, too. It was a Regis rental office in London, which, of course, I found to be suspicious. This was during my initial due diligence. One of the other things, like the website domain name that piqued my interest, and I said to him, here we go. I said, somebody is, and I said, you know, did he ask you about AmTrust? He said, oh yeah, AmTrust did come up during the meeting. So I was like, interesting. Okay. So this is what's going on. I said, somebody's trying to get information on AmTrust is what it appears. I don't know who it is. I don't know if it's the company. I don't know if it's the company's law firm. I have no fucking clue, but here's what it seems like to me. So Dan starts thinking about ways to get security footage of the meeting because we wanted to get a photograph of the woman, which was something that I wasn't able to do during our meeting. And Dan winds up filing a lawsuit and subpoenaing the place where we ate to get this security footage. And we took that security footage that Dan was able to ascertain with my notes, and we punted it to Mark Mermont at the Wall Street Journal, and that was it. And then we didn't hear anything about it, and we just decided, okay, like, this is going away. And then the Wall Street Journal comes out with this article like 2 months later, where Mermont has gone out and talked to all these people and kind of tied these links even closer together. He wasn't really able to confirm, I think, where this woman had worked or what her real name was, but certainly he put her photograph on the front page of the fucking Wall Street Journal, which was crazy because I was in Wawa getting my coffee one morning, and I remember looking down at the Wall Street Journal and thinking, there I am, right on the front page, shaking hands with this woman in this security footage. So anyways, a couple of days go by, and a reporter from the Daily Mail calls me, and she goes, oh, you know, I read this shit in the Wall Street Journal, and we think we might be able to figure out who the person is. And I'm like, oh, interesting, okay. And she goes, you know, if I show you a different photograph, do you think you'd be able to, would you remember the woman? And I said, yeah, definitely. So she shows me another photograph, and it's clearly her. And I'm like, bang, that's it. That's her. Would bet my life on it. And so Daily Mail goes, okay, and hangs up, and that's that. In the interim, I start digging more on the woman, or maybe this was prior. I'm missing the chronology up. But at some point after the meetings, I started to try to figure out what was up with this Facebook profile and who the woman was that was used for the Facebook profile. And I had enlisted a friend of mine to help me try to, you know, reverse Google image search this photo. And we found the woman who the photo was of that was stolen to make up the fake Emily Caron Facebook profile. And, you know, she was contacted and told, hey, just so you know, this photo of you is being used for purposes that we can't really figure out, but it's certainly not you. And so, and her name was, her real name was Ohana, I think. Justine Ohana, I can't remember. So then a couple of days later, out comes the Daily Mail with this story that this woman's name is Stella Penpahonik, and they've dug up some dirt on her that she was a former actress, and she had this video on YouTube of her. But, you know, very limited social media presence, as you would need if you were going to be involved in corporate espionage. And most interesting was the fact that Miss Pahonik had also represented herself as a woman named Diana Philip, F-I-L-I-P, to Rose McGowan, who was writing a book that had dirt on Harvey Weinstein in it. So apparently, allegedly, Weinstein had also hired the same firm to figure out what McGowan had was going to say about him in her book. And this was, I believe, before all the Weinstein stuff shit hit the fan. And what they found out was that, what they later found out was this Diana Phillips, she had represented herself as a woman's rights advocate and somebody that was going to, you know, help Rose McGowan in her fight against Harvey Weinstein as part of the Me Too movement or whatever. And she wasn't who she turned out to be. And as a matter of fact, she wound up befriending Rose McGowan in the process. So they, her, this woman, this who was not who she said she was, this woman, Stella Pahonic, and Rose McGowan wound up becoming friends. And that is when it linked up with me in my head that she was telling the truth when she said she had just been in New York, doing business in New York. She said, oh, I was doing other business or whatever in New York. And I'm thinking to myself, fuck, like she flew over and she took the McGowan meeting and she took my meeting all in the same trip. She also said she, I believe at one point she was going to Toronto after, and I have several speculations as to what was going on there, but none of which I can prove. And at this point, it really doesn't matter. I'm over it. But I have some theories. And I'm thinking to myself, fuck, man, this woman is knocking us both off in the same trip, me and Rose McGowan. So then the second Wall Street Journal article comes out by Mermont called Weinstein Operative Played Another Role, and it talks about Diana Phillips' involvement with Rose McGowan. And I'll read a piece of it here. I'll read the lead, at least. The lead is, Diana Phillip, Israeli undercover operative, meet Diana Illich, a private investigator reported to be working undercover on behalf of film mogul Harvey Weinstein, was identified by two people as the same woman that the Wall Street Journal reported over the summer had used a different alias to wring information out of a critic of a large U.S. insurer. The woman in the Journal article had given her name as Diana Illich. The New Yorker, in an article published Monday about Weinstein's use of private investigators to counter probes into his alleged sexual abuse, named Diana Phillip as a pseudonym by an operative for Black Cube, an Israeli investigative firm. So Mermont makes the link, and I think the Daily Mail was the first to make the link also. And I was like, wow, man, the plot thickens. This is interesting. Then, of course, from there, you know, there was a huge public outcry over the tactics that Weinstein was used, and the woman wound up being, she wound up being kind of put into the spotlight by other women who said that, you know, they were really upset with the fact that she would involve herself with this, especially with, you know, a women's rights issue. And, you know, it had become a big PR problem for Black Cube at the time, who issued a statement and came out and said this, that, and the other. And, you know, eventually it all kind of faded back into the ether. But it was certainly an interesting series of events when it happened. You know, I used to think I was super paranoid and it was kind of stupid for no reason. But in this case, you know, my paranoia kind of helped out. And to this day, you know, it's something that people have to realize it is becoming, it's either being reported on more widespread or it is just becoming more common as a practice to hire these types of firms. Because this morning when I read this Credit Suisse article, you know, it echoed in my head with all these other articles that I have read of late with companies hiring people to go out and kind of dig up dirt on the people that are critical of them. So I guess the moral of the story is keep your wits about you and always kind of pay attention to your surroundings and always assume somebody's watching and always assume somebody's listening. And, you know, I don't harbor any ill will. This woman, Stella Penpahonic, came out some months back and, you know, officially revealed herself and said, hey, this was me and here's the role that I played, and came out and admitted to the whole thing. And I think that was a follow-up that was also done by the Daily Mail. She basically, you know, went out, came out and publicly said that she was sorry for what she had done, and that, you know, she no longer is employed by the firm and this, that, and the other. And she was turning the page in her life. And look, all's well that ends well at the end of the day. I don't have any ill will toward anybody involved in this, and I'm happy kind of letting this float away into the annals of history. But certainly it's a story that I thought was worth telling and getting out there, because some people have asked me about it. And one that, you know, especially if you're a short seller or you're a skeptic or you're a critic, it's kind of important to know that these things actually do happen, have happened before. I don't know what the prevalence of them happening in the future will be. But keep your wits about you and question everything. Because a lot of times when you piss off people with billions and billions of dollars, they're not too happy about it. And they employ interesting means to combat those things, in addition to, you know, lawsuits, which can be debilitating on their own. If you're interested in reading more about this shit, Ronan Farrow did a couple of follow-ups too on the whole Weinstein story recently that I think are worth reading. I read them all. He's certainly done some great investigative journalism on this. So if you're interested in kind of reading more about it, that'd be a really good place to start, and check out those Wall Street Journal articles by Mark Marmont. For now, hey, it's Sunday. Glad you guys were able to join me for my little story here. But there's an Eagles playoff game coming on in a couple hours, and I got things I got to do ahead of that to prepare myself both mentally and physically for beating, hopefully, the Dallas Cowboys. All right, fools, if I don't talk to you, have a Merry Christmas, a Happy Kwanzaa, a pleasurable Ramadan, a mighty Festivus, whatever the fuck you're into, I support it. Happy Hanukkah. I'm out, fools. Peace!